Hello, this is Dr. John Hunt for Pet Sounds 2.0. This is a new one-hour show that we will be broadcasting once a month. And this first show, we're just going to have an interview. And in future shows, there will be a call-in. The purpose of the show is to discuss a wide range of topics about animals, including new veterinary trends, pet care, and all aspects of animals in our lives. Some of the topics will be including nutritional supplements, acupuncture, rehab. We're going to have lawyers and firefighters and a lot of different interesting guests. Hopefully, we'll make this show interesting. Some of you may recognize the title Pet Sounds 2.0 because I've done Pet Sounds as a Sunday morning short for about 4.5 years, and WERU asked me to expand on that, and this is what this hour show is going to be. So for our first show, my guest speaker is, guest interviewee is Dr. Laura Smith. She's the owner of the Bucksport Veterinary Hospital. As a matter of fact, she is the one that bought my practice 1.5 years ago so I could retire. So welcome, Laura, for this for being here and spending some time with me.
Thank you, Dr. Hunt.
Can you tell me a little bit about yourself?
Well, I am somewhat new to the Bucksport area, but I'm not actually new to Maine. I have been practicing in Bangor for the past 8 years. In addition, I was also the coordinator at the veterinary technician program at University of Maine, Augusta, and I moved up to Maine about 11 years ago after graduating from Virginia Tech.
Oh, very good. And what drew you to Maine?
I've always liked Maine, and we used to vacation here, so when I had the opportunity to come up here, I moved to the coast, ended up taking the job in Bangor, and I'm actually really enjoying being back on the coast.
Yes, I had the same reasons to come to Maine. I used to visit Maine in the summer as a child, and I wanted to settle here. So we're both transplants,
but yep.
Great area to be. Also, we've been both involved in the Animal Health Technician Program, and maybe a future show we could cover that and discuss about the program and where it's going and where, as veterinarians, we want it to go.
That'd be great. There's actually a lot of changes happening, and it's a really popular program.
Oh, good. Well, today what we're going to do is we're going to talk about cold weather issues. I have 15 to 20 different things. We may not get to all of them, but hopefully the ones we do get to will be of interest to our listeners. First, I'd like to read an article I found in the paper recently, and it's about thin ice. The title of the article is Dog Rescue Gets Complicated in Freiburg. Rescue crews helped a dog to shore after it fell through the thin ice covering Lovewell Pond. Officials say that there was a visiting family dog wandered out onto the thin ice around noon and could not return to shore on its own. The landowner rescued the dog using a flatboard. However, he became stranded as well and needed to be rescued. The 39-year-old dog owner tried to rescue both her and the friend and the dog, but she fell through the ice as well. She was able to return to shore and call 911. After about 15-20 minutes, the dog was recovered as well as the rescuer. The rescue people do warn pet owners that many dogs are attracted to water and depend on their owners for keeping them safe during thin ice conditions. This winter has been very mild. Usually by January 1st, we have lots of ice and it's very safe. But this year is very dangerous. We really do want to make sure our pet owners heed this advice, is to don't let your dog wander off onto ponds. So the danger of falling through thin ice, obviously, is drowning, but most of the time it's hypothermia. You can tell me a little bit about what you see in a hypothermic dog and how you treat it at the lakeside and what you would do at the vet hospital.
Hypothermic dogs obviously are cold. Their body temperature has dropped below that of normal. They may be shivering. They may not be very conscious depending on how long they were in the water and what percentage of their body was immersed. Typically, if you're falling through ice, I think of more than just the paws being wet. I think of pretty much taking a bath in some pretty cold lake water. The biggest thing is that you've got to get them dry. You've got to get them warm. And, you know, potentially you even need to bring them to the vet. Maybe we need to do, you know, something besides just some basic treatment. But overall, if you can get them warm and dry and they otherwise seem okay, they're probably going to be okay.
So when you say seem okay, a pet owner's thinking, what do you mean by okay? What signs does a pet owner need to watch for to say, I got to go to the vet?
Well, a lot of shaking, tremors that can't be controlled. You know, how is their activity? Are they wanting to do normal activities? Do they want to eat and drink? Do they want to interact with the family? Or do they really seem that they're not aware of their surroundings? Are they seizing? Are they still cold? Are they having trouble coming back to a warm body temperature? You know, when you feel them, do they still feel really cold?
Time frame, half hour, hour?
I would say probably a half an hour.
Okay.
Especially depending on how long they've been potentially in ice water.
So the drying, what that does is reestablish the layer of air on the fur, because the fur acts as a protectant to keep the heat in.
Correct.
Now, warming them up, what do you want to use besides towels? Hot water bottles?
You can certainly use hot
pads.
Water bottles. I tend to tell people, you know, avoid the heating pads because they have settings high and low, and you can actually create a lot of burns. I have seen animals, even if you put a layer of towels, you know, between the heating pad and the pet, I have seen people and animal with superficial burns. And you have to remember, they're not wearing clothes. So especially if you had a thinner fur dog, you can get some pretty significant skin burns. So often better to heat up a hot water bottle and, you know, wrap that in a towel, something that you can comfortably touch in your hand that feels nice and warm. Think about, you know, that chilly night where you have your cup of tea and you're very comfortably holding it in your hands and it feels warm, but obviously you're not burning your skin. If you can take a hot water bottle, microwave it, wrap a towel around it, that's great. Another thing, once you're home, get some nice blankets, you know, throw blankets from your couch and put them in the dryer. Get them nice and warm.
That's
wrap them
idea.
Up in that.
Very
that
good.
Way, you know, they're warm, but there's no risk of being burned. And if they are feeling hot, they have the ability to get up and leave. The other thing that you might want to do is, you know, put your hand under there and think, is this a temperature that seems reasonable? An animal that, for whatever reason, can't get up and walk away could start to become too warm.
Some people may get a little bit panicky because they don't have a hot water bottle. And I've used in the clinic, and you probably do too, is the 1 or 2 liter soda bottles.
Absolutely.
And they work great. And make sure, like you say, even wrap those in a towel.
Yep.
And that's all I use at the clinic. I never had a heating pad because of the dangers that we've seen in veterinary hospitals years ago. It was
awful. There's a lot of commercially made products. And some of them are great, and they have some nice, like, neoprene wraps on them. But even then, most of the time you're microwaving these, and they don't heat evenly. You grab one corner that's really hot.
A hot spot.
Another corner isn't.
Yeah.
You know, just going to your sink, turning your hot water tap on until the water gets nice and warm or hot, and filling up any bottle that you have, even the little Poland Spring bottles that are, you know, common. Sometimes those are nice because you can disperse them, you know, across the length of a dog. Just make sure that there's a layer of towel.
Good. Very good. Well, hopefully that will help our listeners. And that does happen a lot this time of year and again in March.
It does.
When it's starting to melt.
You know, when we have snow cover like this, it gives you a false sense of security that ice is potentially thicker than it really is. And a dog has no idea. They're just running. They see what appears to be a solid surface, and they fall in.
Yeah. And I've had to treat, as you have too, severely hypothermic dogs, hot water enemas, fluid therapy, very extensive, a lot of treatment to try to save our pets. And many of them do come back.
Mm-hmm.
But it is quite a challenge for veterinarians as well.
Well,
outside dogs, really frigid weather. one thing that people always ask about is frostbite and the frequency of frostbite. Have you seen any frostbite?
I haven't seen any this year, but I often see it in cats, mainly on the ears, sometimes on the nose, just because those, if you think about the ears of a cat, they're very thin layer of skin, very easy to get frostbite. And a lot of times, if they're not well protected from the elements, it's really very easy to get.
And do you see commonly, the most common patient that comes in with frostbite are the ones that are compromised, either very old,
very young,
poor nutrition. They just aren't. So the real healthy cat can go outside.
Oh, sure.
As long as they have a place to get out of the wind and rain.
Correct.
Those are the two elements that really will.
I mean, there's people with barns that have barn cats that are quite, cozy. Yeah, I mixed some words together there. But, you know, they're nestled into some hay bales. There's other animals. It's an enclosed structure. There's not a lot of wind going through. Wind chill can be a really big factor as well.
Yep.
But those animals are, you know, they're outside of the elements, might not be 70 degrees, but they're still outside of the elements, and they have a lot of insulation with other animals, walls, hay bales, etc. It's the ones that, you know, are looking for shelter, some of the stray animals, the feral cats, indoor cats that escape. I'd actually like to take this, you know, time just to put a little plug in. We had a client come in quite recently that brought her cat in, not in a carrier. The cat got out of her arms in the parking lot, and it ran into the woods. And that's the prime example of, you know, an animal that, you know, potentially is going to be looking for shelter and have a much harder time finding it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's those indoor cats that, you know, a door gets blown open, they go outside, you don't realize it, and, you know, finding shelter is very challenging.
And the other frostbite cases I've seen are when an animal has an injured part to them. So an injured limb, for instance, would be most vulnerable to frostbite.
Sure.
Ones that have been caught in a trap are the ones that I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
They're out there for 3 or 4 days. The owner finds them, and you have a compromised blood supply.
Correct.
So frostbite can occur with that. So when someone sees a cat coming in from the cold and their ears look kind of gray or a part animal a paw or something like that looks kind of funky. What do you want to tell the owner before you get them in? You don't want to rub it.
No.
That's the worst thing you can do.
You know, so. It's actually, and no, don't put hot things on it. Unfortunately, you know, the body has a real hard time when it's something really cold like that. You know, even with burns and things, just letting it warm up naturally. But if you start putting a lot of hot things on, the circulation isn't there. You can actually cause damage. So, you know, getting them warm, getting them out of the elements is probably going to be the best thing, monitoring it. But if you start, you know, putting, you know, hot water or hot water bottles on some of these things, it may be too hot for that skin.
So heating up too quickly is bad.
Correct. Heating up too quickly is
and
bad.
And don't rub it like you rub your hands when they're cold, because that will just destroy the tissue.
Yes.
And probably it'd be a good idea to see their veterinarian for them to check it out.
Absolutely.
And for the veterinarian to assess the damage and give the pet owner a prediction of what's going to be happening next couple weeks.
Yeah, I mean, some things can be really severe. Others might not need a lot of treatment, but some things, you know, if you've really severely damaged the skin, you know, things could get infected. You know, you might actually need some medical care.
Fortunately, frostbite is pretty rare. Both of us have not seen it very often.
Yes.
Which is good. Clothes on dogs going outside. My little dachshund Hannah, we put a coat on, short hair. She doesn't mind it, seems to be okay. The one time she does mind having something on it is in Halloween when we put a candy corn costume on. She doesn't like that. But some of the short hair dogs, you recommend coats?
I do. It's not usually necessary in the house or for short trips, you know, house to the car. But if you want to do a lot of outdoor things, even some of the bigger dogs, you know, that have really short coats, it's not a bad idea to do something light and also potentially something for the feet. But
we'll talk about the feet in a minute, but
you know,
go ahead with the
body. But the small dogs actually have a much bigger body surface area that is being exposed to the cold. So your small breed dog with short hair is potentially going to get much colder than a large breed dog that has actually less body surface area and potentially more muscle mass and other things that's going to help keep, you know, the body warm naturally.
Very good.
And you need to make sure if you are putting a coat on and doing heavy exercise that they're comfortable too. If you think about heavy exercise, you know, you go and shovel that driveway. I know for myself, sometimes I'm unzipping my jacket a little bit and loosening my scarf because you do start to build up, you know, quite some body heat just from exercise. So you need to monitor them.
And we can segue that into overexertion.
Absolutely.
In the summertime, you're kind of aware of your dog not running 5 miles the first day. You don't think about that in the winter. You have your snowmobile, you're skiing, and you want to go out and cross-country ski for 10 miles. What do you recommend clients?
You have to build up to these things.
Just like anything else.
Just like anything else. I can't just go and go cross-country skiing for 10 miles if I haven't done any other physical activity that makes me prepared for that. I mean, if you're a runner in the summer and then you naturally segue into snowshoeing or cross-country skiing, that's great. But if you've overall, you know, not had a lot of physical activity, then getting up and enjoying the great outdoors is great, but you probably want to limit it the first day or two just so that you know how you feel the next day and for your pet as well.
How about our dogs that are getting into middle age for first 3, 4, 5, 6 years, you're out there doing the the cross-country trails, and all of a sudden one deep snow and you get a little gray on the muzzle of your dog, suddenly they're not making the trip.
And you have to remember, some of these deep snows, you know, you're talking about maybe cross-country skiing, it's fairly level, it's often packed down snow. A lot of the dogs are, you know, running next to you, they're in the snow that's much deeper, they're actually leaping and jumping. You're gliding along the snow, they're actually exerting themselves much more. And if you don't have your dog on a leash, usually they do about twice the distance that we do.
Yeah.
I know my dog often runs ahead and comes back, and I'm pretty sure that they do a whole lot more distance than I end up, and that's going to fatigue them a lot faster.
So be very much aware of your dog's physical condition.
Yes.
And you can always get them in condition by slowly doing some walks.
Absolutely.
I used a snowshoe with my Golden and in really deep snow, and she would follow me. But she never saw the end of my snowshoes because I had real long ones. And every time I lifted my foot, she wanted to be right next to me. She'd get a little bit of a hit in the below the jaw.
Yeah.
Uh-oh. She eventually learned not to do
that. I'm sure.
But she followed me. She was smart. She followed my tracks. Well, water. We're talking about water and food. Of course, we have water all the time indoors, but some dogs that are outside in a pen or area and it's cold, what happens to water in the cold?
It freezes.
And they can't drink it.
And you do have to be really aware. This is actually, being a small animal vet, I tend to think dogs and cats, but this is actually a pretty big issue for some of the horses and things as well that are, you know, outside much more frequently. Even if you have run-in sheds and barns and things, a lot of people have a big trough of water, and you do need to make sure that there isn't a layer of ice. They make a lot of commercially made water bowls that aren't meant to make the water warm, but just meant to prevent it from freezing. Of course, I would warn people, be aware of, you know, fire hazards, make sure that you're using it according to the instructions, but if you have a dog, some of these working dogs, farm dogs, you probably do need to make sure they always have fresh access to clean, fresh water that's not frozen, and those water bowls are a decent option.
So a good rule of thumb is you should check the water a day.
Yeah, at least.
First thing morning, last thing at night, because let's say you have a hose that's feeding at a drip or some kind of automatic feed, that could freeze too.
Absolutely, especially.
So things can happen.
You know, overnight, these negative numbers, even running water can freeze.
And just like any animal, and I even tell my kids that I coach track to, is that even though it's cold, we need more fluids.
Absolutely. And when it's hot and when it's cold.
Yep.
You think of it when you're hot and you're sweating. You don't always think of it when you're cold.
It's the same thing with our dogs.
Yes.
So it's a good thing to keep in mind. Also, the food for dogs that, now we're talking about dogs that are outside all the time. Do you recommend a change diet, add, subtract? Is there anything that you...
Well,
there's more energy.
You're burning a lot of energy just to produce heat to stay warm. So some of these dogs do need either more food or a food that has more calories per cup. And that's something that I would say, you know, you need to look at the back of your bag. You need to ask your veterinarian for help trying to assess, am I feeding my dog enough calories for what they are doing and the conditions that they're in? Some of these dogs, you get these sled dogs, you know, the amount of calories that they need is amazing. And you really do need to make sure you're working with someone that understands the food and your pet to make sure that they're getting enough calories and nutrition.
Do you recommend supplements, additives, or changing the food, or just adding more of the same food? Or all of the above?
All of the above. It really depends on the situation. I mean, for dogs that are being very athletic, probably just more. Some dogs may just need a change or a supplement. It really depends on what they're doing.
Very good. Just to remind you, this is Pet Sounds 2.0, Dr. John Hunt, talking to Dr. Laura Smith on WERU. One thing that I had to deal with 30 years ago was cats that would climb under the hood of a car after it's been run, it's nice and warm, and the owner would come back and start the car up, and the cat would get freak, and as they're trying to escape the engine block, they'd get into fan belt.
Yeah, it's a common injury, unfortunately.
And I haven't seen it over the years. It became, for me, in my experience, less so, because I think the way the cars are modeled now, the fan belts are kind of, not the fan, the blades, the fan blades are kind of protected. But one of the most severe injuries I first saw as a veterinarian my first winter was a fan belt, and it was quite awful. Have you seen any?
I haven't actually seen any recently, but I think that the media actually does a pretty good job reminding people, you know, before you start your car up, bang on the hood. You know, be aware of, you know, where your cat is. What, did you leave it sleeping, you know, in a windowsill, or did you let it out this morning? And maybe it is looking for some shelter, but giving, you know, a nice bang on the hood, especially if you left the car warm, is really a good idea, because it can be a really bad injury. And, you know, as far as outdoor cats and shelter, one of the things, you know, if you have an outdoor cat that is potentially going to be seeking warmth, there's some really great websites and pictures of outdoor shelters that you can build some of these cats. People have used Rubbermaid containers. They've also used big styrofoam coolers. They're easy to come by. If I know I've donated a couple of the styrofoam coolers that some of our refrigerated products have come into the hospital to some of the outdoor cat groups, because they make a really nice enclosed insulated shelter for cats, so that you can put some food and water in there. You can put a little flap for a door, completely enclosed from the elements, and hopefully they're not seeking the hood of your car.
That's excellent advice. Also, if your cat is very old, they're going to sleep deeper, so pounding a little bit harder or honking the horn is another thing. Another danger we have to worry about is, even on a winter day, if it's sunny out, the driveway is kind of warm, and you have some old dogs that like to sleep on the driveway right by the car. So another warning is to make sure you're checking behind your car.
Absolutely.
Sure your older dog is not there.
It's another really common thing.
Yes, we've seen that too many times.
Too many times. It's amazing, and people always feel so bad.
Yeah,
because it happens really quick.
And it's their old dog they've known for 15 years.
Yep.
It's very, very sad. The housing for dogs is very important.
Absolutely.
I think some of the features you had to consider for dog houses. What are some of the things you would make sure that a dog house has?
It really needs to, I think probably the dog houses that I've seen and like the best somewhat for the feature are those igloo-looking ones, mainly because they have a nice opening that bends around. It just helps to prevent wind from going right into that structure. But you really need, you know, a completely enclosed structure so that you're protecting them from the elements. There needs to be some thick bedding, some insulation, you know, so that they can, you know, get warm and be protected from the cold and also from the wind.
So it's not only the cold, wind, but wet as
well.
Yes.
It needs to be
wet,
dry.
Cold, windy is the worst thing for a pet.
I've seen some people actually put dog houses and things up, you know, old pallets and things just to raise it up, give it a little bit more of a floor, you know, just so that, you know, with snow and things being tracked in, water, melting ice, it really needs to not be running into the enclosure.
An igloo idea is good because of the kind of turn the corner to get
exactly.
in. Some of the bedding, we have to watch out for bedding. Some can be actually like a icicle, for instance, towels.
Yep.
I don't recommend towels because remember, dogs breathe. And when they breathe, there's a lot of moisture in their breath, and they can actually freeze the towels. Are there particular substrates of bedding that you like that is good for a doghouse?
You know, a lot of people use straw. It gives you a little bit more of that air barrier, somewhat easy to come by. Some of the synthetic materials that don't keep water as much, your fleecy materials and things, even if you think about what they tell you, and if you're going to be going out, don't wear cotton. Because like most of your towels, cotton's going to absorb sweat and all of your breath and things. Use synthetic materials. Use some of the natural materials, your wood, your straw, cedar chips, you know, maybe as a base and then something on top of it.
So you feel that the cedar chips have worked? Or just as a lower level to
just
kind of insulate
as like
from
a
the
lower
ground.
Level, insulating them, also raising them up, okay. you know, and then putting something on top.
Yeah, straw seems to be
popular.
Popular. It's easy to change,
yes,
but you want to change frequently.
Yes, you need to be able to change these. You have to be aware of, you know, other animals potentially getting in, living in it, you know, food and things, especially with some of the natural products. If they do get wet, they can mold, and that can actually be really dangerous. So
yeah, even in cold weather.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You do need to make sure that whatever you have is sufficiently thick, but also, you know, something that you can clean out.
And they can kind of make a little nest.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Dogs like to scratch in the rug.
Yeah.
And
like I said, sometimes, you know, people will put down a base layer that they're not changing as often, but just getting them up off the ground because the ground's pretty cold, and then putting something on top that they are able to change and clean on a regular basis.
And you do have to worry about rodents.
Absolutely.
Especially if you keep food in there. So
yeah.
You may want to think about where the food's going to be or changing the food or make
Correct.
Sure your dog eats the complete meal and then take away the bowl.
Yes.
Different ways you can get around the mice.
Yes.
Which are very common in our homes at this time of year.
Well, they want to be warm too.
And if you ever want to know where your mice are, just follow your cat. And if your cat is sitting in front of the cupboard underneath the sink staring,
it's probably a mouse.
Probably a mouse. So they're good investigators. Size of the doghouse. Do you have to worry about too big, too small? Can it be too big?
Yes.
You
really
want to make a mansion.
No, you're not trying to make a mansion. You want to make this, you know, a nest. You want to make sure that, you know, body heat and things are being retained. But you need to make sure that I would tend to say if you crate your dog at all, for people that understand the concept of sizing for crates, you want them to be able to walk in, stand up, turn around, stretch out a little bit. But really, that's about it because you need it to be warm and cozy and not huge.
That's a hard concept sometimes for our pet owners. We think that their dog needs the kind of room we like in our living room. And actually, that could be to disadvantage because they won't be able to heat themselves up.
Right.
Now, if you have more than one pet, obviously, you have to make allowances.
You have to make, yeah.
To make sure that's that they can both get up and turn around and stretch out.
Correct.
And that's a very good criteria for kenneling as well.
Yeah.
People ask, how big should the kennel be? Some of my pet owners would buy a big kennel, and they had a puppy, so I told them to put a barrier halfway, so cut it in half so
yeah.
they grow into it instead of buying, you know, one carrier after
yeah.
another. Very good. I think that's good advice for our outdoor animals. Another thing we can talk about is paw protection. That's a huge issue in the winter. We have a lot of different things insulting our dog's paws and things happening. One is salt. Can you give us a little information that you can give us about salt?
Well, if you think about it, animals are walking around. We put shoes and socks on. Our pets are walking around just like they do the rest of the year. All of the chemicals, the sand, the salt that they're putting on the roads, that we're putting on our driveways and walks, you know, especially dogs that have a lot of fur, it's getting balled up in a lot of the snow and ice. It's getting into their feet. It's potentially causing irritation to the feet. And then, of course, dogs go inside and they chew out all those snowballs in between their feet, and they're eating all of that ice, salt, chemical mixture that, you know, has been placed on our roads and sidewalks.
We'll get to the snowball issue and intertoe snowball issue in a minute. But the salt, some clients ask, does it penetrate through the pad, or is it mainly from licking?
I think it really depends on what chemical they've been exposed to. You know, they do make some pet-friendly products that are a little bit less irritating to the pad itself, but you do have to worry about them ingesting it as well.
Do you know much about this pet-friendly? Because I've seen it. I've seen pet-friendly salt. There's a lot of claims of pet-friendly products, and we hopefully we'll get to talk about antifreeze. But before that, are you familiar with this pet-friendly salt?
You know, you have to really read the labels, because some of them, if you look at it, it's the same salt that is in a lot of other products.
Yeah.
So you do need to actually read what you're buying, because the people that do marketing and advertisement are very smart, and you know, they will entice you to buy a product that might not actually be that different. But there are some salt products that are better, but then I've also picked up some and seen the exact, you know, chemical in both brands, and one's labeled pet safe and one's not.
So be careful. Don't buy it if you're not sure, and write down the product and the ingredients and ask your veterinarian.
Yes.
Or you can go online if you have a trustworthy source.
Yes.
That's very important. But always, you know, err on the side of caution.
Yes.
That.
And, you know, I typically tell people, even if you're buying the pet safe products, just, you know, once you're inside, wipe your dog's feet off. You know, just a warm washcloth is fine, just to be able to remove anything, even if it is pet safe. You don't really want that in contact, even if it shouldn't cause a lot of harm. You know, people tend to spread salt down. It lands in piles in some areas and gets nicely dispersed in others. Your dog steps in one of those piles, they're going to have a really heavy amount potentially on the surface of their paw, in between their pads. And if you can just wipe their feet down and then just pat them dry, it's going to be fine.
We're talking with Dr. Laura Smith on Pet Sounds 2.0 on WERU. All right, now we're talking about paw care. Snowballs. I've had, my own dogs have had them, and I've seen other dogs have snowballs, and it can be very painful.
Yes, it can.
You'll have dogs not walking on their feet, and they come in to the clinic, and it's only a snowball, but still, some dogs' fur is conducive to snowballs. Can you tell me what you would recommend a client that has this problem?
You know, keeping their fur somewhat short is helpful. Also, just stopping if you're hiking. I have Goldens. They don't have horribly long fur in between their feet, but if you stop every once in a while, and I just make sure I'm picking the snowballs out so that they're not, A, pulling on the fur. Can't imagine that someone pulling my hair constantly would feel good. And also, it's very cold. It must feel like walking around with a little pebble in your shoe. So, you know, just stopping, clearing out some of the snow. If you take your pet up to like a Petco, PetSmart, you know, major pet store, doesn't really matter where, they do make a lot of dog shoes and things. Some dogs tolerate them really well, others don't. And the other thing that I've found, they're great for walking around town. Another way to protect your dog's feet from whatever chemicals might be on the sidewalk. But in really deep snow, you can pull them off. So it's not really something you want to lose, but it's just another option that works for some dogs, doesn't work for all dogs.
Yeah, I was going to mention that the paw booties.
Yes.
Call them booties. My own dog, Ben, has booties. And we were experimenting with a lot of different kinds.
Mm-hmm.
The one we had been using has a it's a Velcro strap around the top. The problem with that is it's time-consuming to put on. Fortunately, Ben, who's a border collie, just whatever I want to do, he does it. But it does take a lot of time. We've tried other kinds, the rubber, you know, the rubber slip-ons. And in my hands, only in my hands, and Ben's feet didn't work. They slipped off. So there are a lot of products out there, and I highly recommend looking into booties for dogs that are out. He doesn't go out into the deep snow, but he's outside around the house. But you may, not one booty fits all.
No, they really don't, which is why I would say take your dog to a pet store that will let them come in and try these on, because the sizing is not intuitive.
Exactly.
And some dogs have really big feet, but, you know, are otherwise a more narrow frame, and how they fit I found to be very surprising. There's a nice guide on the back, but it's really just a guide.
And always be aware of how easy or hard it is for you to put them on. It's not just the style of the booty, but the style of the dog.
Yes.
Some dogs would just don't like their feet touched, and why spend $20-$30 when he or she just goes nuts?
Yeah.
So that's another aspect to the booties.
But yes.
I really, if it works and the dogs like it,
it's great, but it's not for all dogs.
Right. Toenails. Now, during the winter, they're not running on the cement. So we have toenail growth, and then we have another major problem. But tell me about your recommendations for toenail.
You know, we see so many torn toenails. As that nail grows out and you get that nice crusty layer of snow like we've had recently, where it snowed, it got warm, you got that really crusty layer. The dog's, of course, falling through, and the ice is tearing the toenails. It's very painful. Even if you think about, you know, breaking your own nail, they can bleed, they can get infected, and it can be really a problem. So I recommend keeping your dog's nails short, and if they do break a nail, despite your best efforts, then probably a trip to your vet to have it addressed, potentially have that nail removed, maybe some pain meds or antibiotics, depending on the severity, and, you know, just keeping it covered until it's healed. It's just like with us. You just have to grow that nail back out, and it's not a quick process.
Right. Some people don't realize what's happened, and their dog is limping and lame. And so I recommend people with a dog that's limping after he's been outside in the snow is to get inside, warm him up, and examine the toes for snowballs, for little cuts, and especially that broken nail. Yeah. So many people come in, and as you know, when we do our exam, we specifically look for the nail break, and usually they're broken in half.
Yeah.
And they're very painful. But a lot of people miss it because the nails are hidden in the fur.
Yes.
And they don't realize that that's all, I shouldn't say that's all it is, but that's the cause, not some major.
It can sometimes injury. Be hard to find because the nail from a distance looks normal,
right,
until you kind of part the fur and you look. Nails can split, you know, in lots of different ways and in lots of different locations, and sometimes it's hard to find the nail that has been raised up but now is laying flat again.
Exactly. Kind of that longitudinal,
yes,
split rather than a cut in half like a tree.
Correct.
And that moves every time they step on the ground. It moves up,
yeah,
and down, causing severe pain. So just be, you can be your dog's best friend by just kind of checking those paws out if you see a sudden lameness during the wintertime. Suet and seeds.
Well, the birds love it.
So do the dogs.
The dogs do love it. It tastes good. All that suet's all fat, and you can get some pretty severe, you know, GI and pancreas issues if you eat that.
Seen quite a bit of that. Cats don't seem to. The outdoor cat doesn't seem to eat that. Have you had experience with that?
Cats tend to be much more discerning creatures than dogs. Dogs just assume that if it is at all in their reach, they should eat it. Cats are much more discerning, and the dogs don't typically taste sample. They just eat the entire thing, and that is just too much fat and, you know, seed to ingest.
And a lot of people now are feeding turkeys, so they're putting a lot of corn, cracked corn. In and of itself, is not harmful, because dogs can eat corn. It's just the quantity and the manner that it's presented, which is dried.
Correct.
Millet is another thing you put on the ground for the mourning doves and that sort of thing. Okay. So I guess you have to be very careful when you're putting seed for the ground feeders, especially the turkeys, as to if your dog can get to it or not.
Yeah, it's better to have it, you know, in an area that your dog typically isn't. But That said, if you're out and about with your dog, you don't know what they might find.
Yeah. And a lot of people do put the suet on the ground. My suet is hanging up for the woodpeckers and stuff, so I'm not sure how a dog can get suet.
No, but you know, they fall. A lot of these chains rust out over the years. They fall to the ground. A lot of little kids will also make, like, you know, bird seed type things. A lot of people that buy suet in their containers, it's a nice wire container. It's a little harder for a dog to just, you know, gulp, you know, an entire block of suet. But, you know, some of these other ones, you know, the little bell-shaped ones, they're not coming in that nice wire container. They're homemade, which is great, but, you know, once again, strings break, chains squirrels rust, squirrels yank them off.
And the next
thing you know, what was safely away from your dog is now right on the ground in front of them, and their self-control isn't that good.
That's true. That's true. So if you, if a pet owner calls you and says, my dog just ate a bunch of seed, and I mean, they actually saw it, what do you give advice over the phone, and when do you say you better come in?
It really depends on the timing. I mean, if they literally just saw it, then you can certainly do peroxide and, you know, call your vet for dosing. But, you know, peroxide, it says don't ingest because it makes you vomit. And in this case, you know, it works great. My dog over Christmas ate an entire bag of peanut butter balls. And I'm pretty sure he enjoyed them going down. I don't know if he enjoyed them when I made them come back up. But, you know, if you see your dog, you know, out the kitchen window, chowing down on that suet, you know, inducing vomiting is an okay thing to do. But call your vet, make sure there's no contraindications for your pet's health condition, and also to get a dose. But it's something that most people have sitting in their bathroom cabinet, and it is effective.
And if not, they should have some.
Yes.
And a dosing syringe or something like that, because you don't know when you're going to need it. Timing is important.
Timing is very important.
First half hour is probably your, after that, then
the stomach starts to empty in about 30 minutes. So you've already started digesting that. And, you know, once you've already digested it, vomiting isn't going to really do any good.
And always call your vet to make sure you're doing the right thing.
Yes.
Do not use salt.
No.
You can get salt toxicity.
Yeah, don't use salt.
That's an old remedy that us younger vets say not to do. There is some medication, apomorphine is one thing, but only veterinarians have that.
Yeah.
So that's not something you have on hand. The vomiting, when you give the peroxide, just as a note, because you and I both have done it to our own dogs, you probably notice this too, it takes a little longer than you think.
It does.
And you have to keep dosing. So just one dose usually doesn't do it, but you don't want to give too much at once.
No, I usually recommend a dose. And then walk them around. You know, the more you can kind of agitate it in the stomach, get it foamy.
Yeah, that's what,
you know, usually the quicker it'll come up. And then I give it 5 or 10 minutes before I redose to, you know, make sure I really need to be redosing. There's no reason to give more.
True.
We just have to be patient. And, of course, when you're worried, you lose, you know, track of how long it really has been.
Yeah. So be patient. It may take up to a half an hour.
Absolutely.
May take 2 or 3 doses.
Yes.
And that's one thing our pet owner sometimes calls up. It didn't work, and we just have to give them encouragement to keep going.
It always amazes me that some dogs vomit almost immediately, and others do take almost that 30-minute.
Yeah. Even with apomorphine, I've noticed
sometimes
it takes a long time.
It really can.
So it's an individual thing. But please call your veterinarian before you induce vomiting. Because depending, of course, if you ate seed and stuff, that's okay. But there's some products that they ingest that could cause more damage coming up.
Absolutely.
So,
batteries and things,
yeah,
especially, you know, Christmas time.
Yeah,
all
that
stuff.
You
know, all those toys.
Sharp thing. I mean, it's just a myriad. So if they didn't do vomiting, they got some vomiting up and some of the seed came up, but the dog was acting funny, what kind of thing? When do you tell them to come in?
If they're acting funny, unfortunately, I would say come in sooner than later. Your vet might feel that it's just a mild GI upset from, you know, eating things that they shouldn't have eaten. They might be able to just give you some medication and send you home. Some dogs can inflame their pancreas very severely, and actually need, you know, hospitalized treatment. It really depends on how much they ate, how sensitive your pet might be, what other underlying health problems might predispose them to certain conditions. And it might be something, like I said, your vet might be able to just treat it and send you home. Other animals, if they get a severe pancreatitis, that's typically something that we hospitalize them for.
So the message we would both like to give our listeners is please call your veterinarian. Establish a relationship with your veterinarian so they know your dog, they can look at the medical history, and that your veterinarian and their staff can give you good, sound advice.
Absolutely.
Going online could be good, but could be terrible. So you know your veterinarian is going to be reliable, and if they're not in, they have a number for an emergency clinic. We have a very good one up in Bangor that can give you good advice. So I just overemphasize that recommendation.
And I'll put a plug in. There's a new emergency clinic in Warren now. So for our listeners that are more on the coast, it's been open since the summer. I've had a couple clients that are from the more southern end of our practice that have used them and, you know, have thought them very good. So now you have two options.
So you see what happens when I retire?
I know.
I don't get all the dope here. Dogs getting lost. Cats don't seem to get lost. But dogs can, especially ones that are, they go out scared and they start running away. What can you tell me about that? Do you give any advice or?
You know, knowing your dog is probably a good thing. If your dog is one to run after deer and you take it, you know, a few miles from the house to a trail, they may not know how to get home. And if they, you know, smell something that, you know, a trail that they want to go off after, maybe that dog should have, you know, some sort of leash, even if it's a long one. Some dogs, like your dog that you were talking about, stay right with you, less likely to run off. ID tags are great, but of course, collars can be ripped off. Microchips are a really nice thing because they're permanent, and all of your vets and shelters can scan for microchips. It's a really nice way to bring lost dogs home, and those also come with, you know, a tag that you can put on the collar alerting people that this dog has been microchipped. But once again, tags only work if the collar stays on.
And also on the interweb, this is a good thing, is towns have, for instance, Orland has a trade, swap, and sell site. And a lot of people put their lost dogs on that, or it'd be Bucksport Trade, Swap, and Sell, or Orland. And you may want to look
either. Maine Lost Dog Recovery
is
really good as well. They're very big. They put things out. And, you know, even just calling your vet, calling the shelters, alerting them to the fact of where you were, what your dog looks like, so that they know if a dog was brought in, that it does have an owner. Alerting your vet, vets in the area. We have so many people that find dogs and they bring them to us because they simply assume that they must be my client. And sometimes, as in this summer, we have so many visitors. We actually had someone that was traveling and the dog got away, but we were able to locate the owner. But, you know, contacting the local vets, a lot of, you know, now with social media, people put things on Facebook. We've put lost animals on our Facebook page. And it's amazing how many people share these photos so that if someone sees these animals, they do get home.
That's one advantage of social media.
It is.
But if you do put your lost dog on and you find them, please take your...
Please let us know.
Yeah, and take it off the social media. Have they devised any GPSs for
They're
dogs?
They're working on it.
It hasn't come
but
out
it
yet.
Hasn't come
I'm
out.
Surprised.
Unfortunately, the GPS has to generate a signal. And doing that creates heat because it needs energy. And implanting something that potentially is generating heat is not a comfortable thing to have implanted under your skin. So I know that there are companies working on it, but to my knowledge, there isn't a GPS yet. I have seen people that have put GPSs on collars. And, you know, you once again, as long as the collar stays on the pet, you can locate them.
Okay.
But that's not, you know, a microchip per se.
Okay. Yeah, the microchip is simply a identification for a veterinarian or animal control to scan to get a number, and then you call in to the main resource bank for that company, and they tell you who it is. The other thing is these microchip people are now getting more into sending out, going to the area where it's lost and contacting they're contacting all the vets and all the animal control. So it's really
one of the other things that they do. When you register them, you can put a lot of emergency contacts. You can also put information about your dog that says, hey, my dog has a medical condition, it needs medication, or it's scared. Things that, you know, someone that finds your dog and might think, well, I'm just going to keep it overnight. They don't want me to call. It's really late. I'll call them first thing in the morning. If that dog needs medication or something, it would be right there on the website when they identify the dog, and that can be really helpful to some of these pets with chronic medical conditions.
People ask, wonder why winter is such a problem. A couple reasons. One is the smelling. That you don't have really good odors in cold weather. Mm-hmm. Also, the visual cues that dogs may use are changed. And also the ability to get around
in
deep snow. They just get exhausted.
Yes.
So be really careful about having your dogs wander off. Some run away, and that's a real problem.
And the other thing, last year when we had so much snow, the snow was, you know, especially with drifts, some dogs were just stepping over their fences.
Yeah, that's right. I had a client like that too. They just, it was a big dog, and it was like 8-foot fence. He just stepped over. That was it.
You know, there's only 2 feet, you know, really containing them, and they just small little jump and they're running free.
Yeah.
We don't seem to have that issue quite yet this year, but you never know.
Never know.
Winter's still young.
Wood stoves.
Oh, they can cause some burns.
Yeah, probably. I used to see them around October, first cold night. The cats used to sleep on the stove, and all of a sudden you put your wood in. And so, what have you seen?
A lot of burn pads is probably the most common. You know, some of them severe enough that they've actually sloughed off a portion of, you know, the outer portion of the pad. And those just have to be treated as, you know, a burn wound. They need to be kept clean, dry. And of course, that skin is now more prone to infection. But definitely wood stoves are hazardous to paws.
Especially in the beginning when they're first starting. How about tips of ears? I've had some pets sleep underneath the wood stove.
Yeah.
And their ears get burned. Have you seen it?
I haven't seen that as much, but I can see that happening.
And how about the pattern of dry skin that I used to see in the wintertime? Really flaky skin along the back where they've curled up, and the right, that part of the back is exposed to the dry heat.
Yes.
So what do you recommend?
I usually recommend people, you know, put one of those big, you know, a kettle or one of those big cast iron pots are on the top of their stove and, you know, boil some water. Use that heat, get some steam, humidify the room. Helps the people, helps the pets. You know, sometimes adding, you know, additional fish oil supplements and things can be good just to, you know, relieve some of the symptoms of dry skin. Make sure that the fatty acids that are needed for good, you know, metabolism within the skin itself, you know, is there for the pets. And just keeping them away if it is a problem.
If you saw a patch of dry skin on the back, and it looks like it's from the heat, it's not a metabolic problem or some other disease, are there products out there that you can put on the skin to help moisturize it, like hand cream for people?
There are products, but I would tend to say make sure it's an animal-safe product and make sure that if you are putting it on, they're not licking it off. May or may not be a problem if they're licking it off, but sometimes cats especially, you put something topically on and then they just want to lick it, and sometimes that actually makes it worse. In addition to the fact that whatever you just put on your cat as a topical medication, they just took orally.
So there's some sprays out there as well.
There are some nice sprays that dry much quicker.
And you can rub it in.
People tend to go for like your bag balm type ointments that are much stickier. But, you know, that's where I say do one of the animal safe products meant to, you know, be incorporated into the coat more so than, you know, the sticky materials that are just going to kind of clump the fur.
Bag balm is a very, very common medication taken off the shelf to treat our animals. That could be a whole different show.
Yes.
But one thing to remember is bag balm in moist skin conditions just will make it worse. So we generally, I don't say bag balm could help on the paw, on the bottom of the paws.
On skin, but you know, if you're matting that fur down, you're preventing the air from getting into it. Sometimes you're trapping bacteria and things underneath.
Yeah. So it's a good idea to call your vet.
Call your vet.
This is something that people never think about, and it is the season, fleas.
Fleas.
This is flea season, right?
It amazes me every year how many fleas I still see, and this year, how many ticks I'm still seeing. But it was 60 degrees on Christmas Day,
right?
And if you have grass that you can see, it might actually be warm enough to have ticks, and I have seen fleas and ticks this winter.
Now, from my understanding, with the ticks in this area, if it's over 40 degrees, ticks will come up even if there's a lot of snow. They'll come right up out of the onto the grass.
Especially the deer ticks. They really like the cold weather.
Yeah.
They like the late fall and the early spring. They like it cold. By the time we get into the middle of summer and it's hot, you're still seeing ticks, but not as high a percentage of them are your deer ticks.
Right, especially in August, they seem to disappear.
They don't like it hot, but you know, you get a 60 degree Christmas morning, and yeah, those ticks are celebrating it with you.
Or that midwinter thaw that you get in February when it's 40, you're out there with your t-shirt. Well, so are the ticks.
Yeah.
So be aware of that. Now, fleas, people say fleas in winter.
Absolutely.
What's with that?
Well, if you go into your fall or your winter with even just a couple eggs that are viable. You know, most people are keeping their house somewhere between 60 and 70 degrees, and that is plenty warm for the fleas. And if you have a pet, then, you know, certainly they can thrive and multiply, and boy, do they multiply fast.
This is a client response. Where did they come from? It's snowing outside.
But, you know, the body surface of the animal is nice and warm. Wild animals have a lot of fleas. If you have pets that are going outside, even brief periods of time, you know, you're feeding, you know, your turkeys and your squirrels and things like that, you're potentially going to have a flea that jumps off. Your cat walks by, jumps on the cat, and gets a free ride into your toasty warm house.
And how about I like to talk to my clients about the ecosystem in your house. So the fleas in the fall.
Absolutely.
How do fall fleas translate into winter fleas?
Well, the flea eggs actually fall off of the animal and they get spread into the house. And what a lot of people, you know, don't think about is, you know, these eggs get swept underneath furniture and things. And even though you've cleaned your floors and vacuumed, especially with carpets, those eggs get stuck. It's nice and warm. The eggs hatch. And the next thing you know, if you haven't treated your pet, those eggs are hatching into larvae, developing into fleas, replicating, taking a blood meal from your pet, and laying more eggs.
So instead of thinking they got fleas, they just have always had them.
They've likely always had them. And, you know, a lot of people are very aware of fleas, but they get a little bit more lax once the weather turns cold. They forget about, you know, putting a dose of flea meds on. And it only takes one or two fleas that you pick up to, you know, a month or two later have an infestation of them.
So word to the wise, keep your flea treatment all year.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, we've run out of time. I have more things here I want to talk about. Maybe you can come back another time.
Absolutely.
Talk about some of the diseases of that we see in the wintertime.
Absolutely.
But this is Dr. John Hunt for Pet Sounds 2.0. We've just been talking with Dr. Laura Smith from Bucksport Vet Hospital about winter problems. And until next time, enjoy your pet and don't forget to give them a hug.